Most Germanic tribes in Europe and Northwest Africa were Aryan and persecuted Catholics. The most famous victim in Italy was the great Western philosopher and theologian Boethius. Boethius lived 480 to 524 AD. We have some interesting information on Boethius. Boethius was a great Western philosopher and theologian, and he was a Roman with blood relation to two previous Roman emperors. He had quite a pedigree in his family. So he's an aristocrat, he was a Roman, very well educated. Boethius was educated in Athens and Alexandria. You know, Athens, the center of Greek philosophy. And as well, you remember, Rome was the capital of the Roman Empire, but the intellectual capital was Alexandria. That was the cultural capital. And he was educated in Athens and Alexandria. Nick Needham says this about Boethius. He was probably one of the most learned men in human history, unquote. Now, this is from Nick Needham, the scholar on church history that writes all of church history, from the beginning all the way up to where we are. And he says Boethius is probably one of the most learned men in human history. That's quite a statement, really. Now, he had counseled for a while in Italy the Ostrogothic king. The Ostrogoths settled eventually in Italy. So this Germanic tribe, the Ostrogoths, controlled Italy, and their king was King Theodoric, who was king 471 to 526 AD. But there was a falling out between this king and Boethius. Boethius is awaiting a horrific death. And if I recall correctly, the king gave the order for the men to kill him with clubs, club him to death. Boethius wrote The Consolation of Philosophy when he was imprisoned waiting this horrific death. The Consolation of Philosophy. Now, I think I put it on the board later on there. For 1,000 years, this writing of his, The Consolation of Philosophy, was admired in the West for 1,000 years. One of his themes in that work that he wrote was that the soul's true and eternal treasure is God Himself, which no one can rob. So he was there saying, so I've lost all earthly things. Who cares? The soul's true and eternal treasure is God Himself. They can't take that from me. It's one of the reasons why it was treasured for a millennium. Boethius also reflected on God's justice, God's providence, and foreknowledge. But there's that sense in which he's acknowledging that God is my portion forever. Like Psalm 73, 25, and 26. They can't take God from me. They can kill the body, but they cannot kill the soul, Matthew 10, 28. I know in whom I have entrusted myself with, God Himself. And He will keep until that day. Well, Boethius tackled in his writing, The Consolation of Philosophy, a difficult question. If God knows I am going to make certain decisions, then they must happen. If God knows, He knows I'm going to make certain decisions in the future, then they must happen. Well, then where is my freedom? If you say that, well, then they must happen. He knows all things. He has all knowledge. He knows the future. If God knows the future, then my decisions must happen. So then where is my freedom? Boethius offered what became the classic solution to this question. He said that God does not experience time as we do, as past, present, and future. God does not dwell in time, since he himself created time and space. You think of Romans 8, 38 to 39. When nothing shall separate us from the love of God in Christ, and you think whether things above or below, things here or yet to come, you think of space and time, or any other created thing. No created thing should be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ. Time and space are created, and God's the one that created time and space. He dwells in eternity. God is above the limits of time and space. God views the whole of time in a single glance. Dwelling in eternity, he sees it all as if it's all in the present, in a sort of an eternal now. When we look at the clock, tick, 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 the second hand is moving. Well, that's motion, that's change. God does not change. You and I, dwelling in time and space, we're involved in change. Anything creaturely changes. But God is eternal. He does not change. He dwells in an ever-present now. And in a sense, God sees the whole of time in a single glance, as if it was all present in an eternal now. God sees future things as we see things happen in the present. And what Boethius said is, as we do not cause someone to perform a free act merely by seeing it, so God's foreknowledge does not make us puppets. Just because I watch you do something doesn't make you a puppet. Now, he's dealing with foreknowledge. He's not delving fully into providence on that topic. But for 1,000 years, the consolation of philosophy was admired in the West. And in particular, it's this sense of saying earthly things are not very valuable. What is valuable is God. And God is my portion forever. Now, in that book, The Consolation of Philosophy, Boethius makes no mention of Christ. And Nick Needham says that Boethius was as much a Neoplatonist as a Christian. He was centered on God, the soul, and life after death in that particular work. Now, it's a particular work on the consolation of philosophy. You say, well, what was the purpose of the book? And that's the way he wrote it. But interestingly, what he focused on were truths that Neoplatonism and Christianity shared. And we talked about Neoplatonism. It's kind of a religious form of Plato's philosophy. And if you remember anything about Plato, you remember that he says it's the realm of ideas that's real, the spiritual realm. It's almost like two worlds exist. And the physical realm is the realm of shadows, the imperfect world. And the real world is the world of ideas, perfect ideas. And they exist. In Neoplatonism, there's this sense of degrees of goodness, and going down away from God is more material things. And as you get closer to God, it's pure spiritual things. But he focused on God, the soul, and life after death, and facing suffering, and thinking about what really values in life in that work, The Consolation of Philosophy. There's no true knowledge of God apart from Christ, John 17:3. And yet you and I have to remember that compared to the chaotic, irrational, pagan gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and of the Germanic tribes, to believe in order in the world, rational order, is huge. And that's where Neoplatonism is much closer to Christianity than anything from the pagan gods and goddesses of the Germanic tribes and of the Greeks and the Romans. Now, it was an education that really Boethius shaped, really the church and the West. Had a lasting impact in education. And the education that he promoted was derived from pagan Rome. And the education would dominate Western medieval Europe. So for another 1,000 years, his form of education will dominate medieval Europe in the Western world. His education was centered on two things, the trivium and the quadrivium. The trivium and the quadrivium. If you remember anything about Dorothy Sayers, a scholar of literature at Oxford with C.S. Lewis, and she wrote an essay on the trivium. Right now, it's probably about 30 years ago, I went to a conference with my older brother and his wife on the Association of Classical Christian Schools. I was just getting going in America. The Association of Classical Christian Schools, and they focused on the trivium. Douglas Wilson had written a book on rediscovering the lost tools of learning. Rediscovering the lost tools of learning, focusing on the trivium. And this is going all the way back to Boethius, which predates him because he's bringing it in from pagan Rome. How did they educate people? With the trivium and the quadrivium. The trivium is Latin for place where three ways meet. What's the trivium? It's the place where three ways meet. What's the quadrivium? It's the place where four ways meet. But the trivium involves three subjects: grammar, rhetoric, and logic. Grammar, rhetoric, and logic. The quadrivium, the place where four ways meet, focuses on arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Now, you say music. Well, think back to those in my Western Civ class. Pythagoras died 500 BC. Many of you learned the Pythagorean theorem in your geometry class. He's the one that said the RK, the root of all things, is math. That was his theory. He was a pre-Socratic that said the RK, or root of all things, is math. But he and his followers of Pythagoras, that ancient Greek philosopher, discovered that in music is grounded in math. Music is mathematical. As Nancy's tried to teach the youth the various scales and the beat and rhythm that takes place. It's mathematical. So the quadrivium had arithmetic, where you're adding and subtracting and multiplying and all the basic there, and then geometry with the shapes and everything, of sizes and relationships and things, and then music, which was mathematical, and then astronomy, which was also mathematical. Grammar is all of the basic details of every subject. What's the grammar of history? Well, do you know where the Danube River is? Do you know where the Rhine River? Do you know what continents are called in the oceans and the names of things, right? The grammar of things. Logic, then, is how to think, right? Aristotle is the one, died 323 BC, of the ancient Greeks, that discovered rules of thought and was able to enunciate and explain them, the law of non-contradiction, for existence. As R.C. Sproul would say, Aristotle did not invent logic. He discovered it. It's there. This is the way God made us rational. In God's image. He has a mind. We have a mind. We're rational. And we're under certain laws of thought. How we think. And the law of non-contradiction is something cannot be both A and non-A at the same time or in the same relationship. Rhetoric is how do you say something beautifully, poetically. And this is where in the classical Christian schools nowadays, they start with grammar in the elementary school, teach them all the facts, basic words and names. And then you move into logic once the teenager begins to challenge, well, parent, you told me this, but now you're telling me something contradictory. We begin to think logically around a teenager, and then they fall in love. So then you try and teach them rhetoric, how to say something beautifully, poetically, persuasively. But with the quadrivium, you're also teaching arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Now that would dominate, think of that, for the next 1,000 years in the Western world. Most of the New West's knowledge of the old Greek philosophy was from Boethius. In the old Greek philosophy, he had translated into Latin the treatises of Aristotle on logic, for instance. So Boethius was educated in Athens and Alexandria. He knew Greek. Most in the West only knew Latin. So he's translating the Greek works into Latin. So then most of the New West knowledge of the old Greek philosophy is from Boethius because he translated the works into Latin, the language they understood. And he also translated the writings of the great Neoplatonist philosopher Porphyry, who died around 305 AD.